they are still fumbling around trying to figure out how to attack the Democratic ticket, how to attack Kamala Harris. They're calling her names. They're using the juvenile insults.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, we catch up with Errol Lewis about New York politics and national politics. The summer conventions are over and the fall campaign season is here. It brings with it an unexpected matchup for president, key races for Congress across New York, and looming decisions in the state legislature that could put Governor Kathy Hochul to the test. Well, joining me for an update on Empire State politics is Errol Lewis of Spectrum News and New York Magazine. Errol, good to see you again.
Great to be with you, Ian.
So just broadly to begin with, where do you think we are right now, past conventions, pre-first debate?
Well, we're in this interesting spot where the candidates are having to make some really serious choices that can't necessarily be reversed later on. We're in the final sprint, you know, 70-odd days until Election Day, even less than that if you start factoring in early voting dates. The time is really upon us. So you've got candidates and campaigns trying to figure out what their message is going to be and which states they're really going to fight over. We often talk about how there are only a handful of battleground states. As far as I can tell, there are exactly six that are really in contention, maybe seven if North Carolina gets wedged in there. And it's going to be a dogfight to figure out how to introduce the candidates, line up their supporters, talk to the persuadable independents, raise money at the same time. It's just a big, confusing, wonderful mess that we call democracy at this stage of the game.
You know what was interesting for me watching remotely during the conventions? The Republicans thought they had a killer convention. They were on cloud nine, and the Democrats thought the same thing. You had two parties come out of it with a whole lot of confidence and then throw in between the two the huge change in standard bearer for the Democrats. So have we ever seen something like this before where, you know, both parties really felt like they might be the favorites after the convention?
Well, look, the sequence really matters. The Republicans, I agree, had a great convention. I mean, it was almost picture perfect. You know, the acceptance speech, the historically long acceptance speech that meandered a little bit by Donald Trump was maybe the only shadow over what was otherwise a very well-produced, very effective, very powerful convention that, of course, was immediately preceded by the failed assassination attempt that turned the candidate into a martyr or a hero of some kind. So they did do that. Now, you know, everything else that followed, I think, has been disastrous for the Republicans. I mean, the Democrats came in to a convention that had a surge of energy that was very different in kind than what you saw with the Republicans because they just found their candidate. I mean, it was, you know, nobody anticipated it. Nobody thought Kamala Harris was or knew that Kamala Harris was going to be the candidate. The energy was unbelievable. And, you know, I mean, there are a lot of interesting little indicators. One of my favorite ones was the reported jump in hotel prices and Airbnb prices in Chicago after she became the nominee, when people realized, oh, I actually have to be there. This is something interesting and exciting and different. So I think the Democrats came out of it. And, you know, I mean, look, the other metric to look at is dollars raised. They raised a ton of money from the minute she got into the race, and they even raised money in record-setting amounts during and just after the convention. So, they've both got it together. But, you know, the Republicans have been on the back foot ever since her nomination was sealed, because they have not figured out what I detect. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are about this, Ian. But my sense is that they are still fumbling around trying to figure out how to attack the Democratic ticket, how to attack Kamala Harris. They're calling her names. They're using the juvenile insults. They're making stuff up. They can't figure out what they think the problem is, and therefore they can't figure out how to solve the problem. The Republican Party and Donald Trump had really very closely optimized everything they did toward the idea of knocking Joe Biden out And then Joe Biden just kind of slipped out the side door, and they simply don't know what to do at this point.
Yeah, I think the attacks on Biden were pretty clear. You know, he's too old. He's kind of doddering. Kamala Harris, you know, the things that cost her in the presidential primary in 2020, she's a prosecutor, she's a cop. She can't be that and a communist. I mean, those attacks that we've heard of late, they just don't go together.
That's right. That's where you see the dissonance that tells you that they have not figured out how to solve their problem. Is she a prosecutor or is she a radical? Is she incompetent and unable to measure up? Donald Trump has said things like she's not very smart, you know, or she's got the laugh of a lunatic, you know, or is she a hyper effective tool of the radical left? You know, like, which is it, right? So until they figure that out, and I understand they've got to get in the field, they've got to do some polling, they've got to do focus groups, they've got to, of course, clear everything with the candidate. And they've got to figure out which are the states that they really want to play in, so that everything you and I have just talked about has to sell well in parts of Pennsylvania and parts of Wisconsin and parts of Michigan and, you know, all throughout the South. And so they've got a really tough assignment at this point. And make no mistake, the Democrats have to also really execute. And the fact that you see of the Harris-Waltz ticket going on a bus tour through Georgia and making, I think, what has been her eighth or ninth visit, Kamala Harris, is to North Carolina, which is a state Democrats have pretty consistently lost over the last generation, tells you that they're not taking anything for granted either.
Yeah, I guess the more paths you can give yourself. So when Elise Stefanik said at the GOP convention that New York might go Trump's way this year, that was just heat of the moment. You don't see that, do you?
No. I mean, look, in the same way that Democrats have said, oh, yeah, we might put Florida in play. Oh, really?
Yeah, starting now.
Because my wife and a lot of family members are from Florida, I actually kind of keep an eye on that state and visit it quite often. And I do believe that if they were going to try an expansion of the traditional map, that might be the place for Democrats to look. But it's such an expensive proposition. There's something like 10 major markets there. You know, it's bigger than New York at this point as far as population. And it's not something that people are really going to invest in any more than Republicans can, will, or should, frankly, invest a lot of money in the state of New York. It just doesn't look very likely for Donald Trump here.
So let me ask you some Kathy Hochul questions, Errol. It's maybe ancient history now, but there was a really interesting schism that emerged between Hochul and her lieutenant governor. When Hochul went to the White House, she met with Biden. She gave him a pledge of support in public during that time when it wasn't clear if he would stay in the race or not. And Lieutenant Governor Delgado said Biden should go. He went on CNN in an appearance that was not advised anywhere. What do you make of that split? And for her part, Hochul has tamped down conversation that she's mad at him or whatever, but it was notable.
Well, look, my sources tell me that she wasn't and is not happy that that happened. On the other hand, she's very different from her predecessor. You know, if it was Andrew Cuomo who'd been crossed that way by a lieutenant governor, that lieutenant governor would have been exiled to the North Country or something, you know.
highway therapy.
Yeah, highway therapy. There's some real important meetings up there on the Canadian border we want you to look into around Christmas time, you know. But if they're not going to do that, if Hochul's not going to do that, then she's got until 2026 to figure out what the rules of the road are going to be with her lieutenant governor. The fact that she herself was a lieutenant governor and a loyal one, frankly, tells you that she understands the job, she understands its limits, and she understands what she as governor can do if she wanted to punish, reassign, or otherwise have some kind of a conversation with Antonio Delgado. It does appear, though, I have to tell you, in hindsight, to have been an honest statement of his, you know, deeply held beliefs, that he just thought ethically it was just the right thing to do. It'll be interesting to see if there's any retribution in New York or anywhere else for people who were, you know, prematurely on board with with the Democratic nominee. I think that provides a level of protection that'll probably see Antonio Delgado through.
I mean, you and I both know there were many more Democrats who wanted to see Biden go who hadn't said so publicly at that time during the slow drip. So how did Hochul do in Chicago? She got a primetime speaking address on Monday of the convention, but she also got some backhanded comments from former Speaker Pelosi that made a lot of headlines.
Well, she very much wanted to speak on the same night as President Biden. She associates herself and wanted to be publicly associated with support of the president and with his wing of the party, if you want to call it that. A centrist Democrat. That's who she is. That's who she wants to be seen as. That's what she wanted to be on the national stage espousing. And that indeed is what she did. What you're referring to, I think, is the kind of sort of side eye, a little back and forth between New York and California. And to be honest, and we don't have to be New York chauvinists, the numbers simply bear this out. I was talking about this with a strategist just the other day. Everybody gets on Kathy Hochul in New York for having lost four seats that ended up in this telling being the margin of the majority that the Republicans now hold in the House of Representatives. Nobody talks about the seats that were lost in California, and there were more than a few in California. Nobody bothers Nancy Pelosi about that. Nobody bothers Gavin Newsom about that. They're not blamed for the Republicans taking control of the House, although they have some responsibility there. So, the nice thing about a convention is everybody has to put on a happy face and say we're all unified. But of course, under the surface, there are little rivalries, conversations about who really deserves credit or blame. And the most practical person in all of this is Hakeem Jeffries, who wants to be the Speaker of the House, is trying very, very hard to win a Democratic majority. And frankly, is spending a lot of time, not just in the Hudson Valley and in Long Island and in upstate and up in Syracuse, but also a lot of time out in California. I mean, that, you know, like you, it'll take everybody working together to get a majority. And I think Nancy Pelosi understands that full well.
Well, I always like to ask you about the New York City race while we have you. So, you know, since we talked the last time, we actually have some candidates who are in the field now against Eric Adams. And there's, of course, the question about the FBI investigation into the mayor that's kind of hanging over things. But as we sit here in August speaking, how do you feel about Eric Adams' chances in the new year?
Well, look, every incumbent mayor starts out with many huge advantages, and Eric Adams enjoys all of those advantages. The power of incumbency. We have a strong mayor system, to say the least, that puts the mayor in charge of, you know, the police department and the Department of Education and the budget. And, you know, there's more than $100 billion in the budget, and the mayor has very prominent control over much of it. So, he starts out with a lot of advantages. The fact that so many people have gotten into the race, though, tells you that they, as professional politicians, see something that maybe the rest of us don't see. And I've learned over the years to respect their judgment. So if a professional politician like Brad Lander and Senator Zelnor Myrie and Scott Stringer, who's been in politics literally his whole life from the time he's in elementary school, if these gentlemen size up the situation and say, I think I see a path here. I think I see a weakness here. I think I see a problem here. I'm not going to dismiss that out of hand. And the fact that they're all in and that we have this new system, I think, is what really makes it interesting, Ian, because this will only be the second citywide election using our new ranked choice voting system in the primary. And if those three candidates I just listed, plus whoever else gets in the race, if some or all of them should decide to run as a team against the incumbent, then Eric Adams has a real serious problem. And not to bore your listeners with all of the math, but the reality is we've seen this in a couple of places. It happened in Oakland, actually, about a generation ago. It's how they got their first woman mayor. If a bunch of candidates all run on the proposition that, hey, you can vote for any of us, just don't vote for Eric Adams. If they should say that, and if people actually respond to that, then he might not escape the way he did in 2021. And just real briefly, in that primary, and there were at least nine candidates in that primary in 2021, Eric Adams was first in the first round with over 100,000 votes. And by the time the dust settled, because he was not everybody's second choice, he came within 7,000 votes of losing to Catherine Garcia, who had never run for any office in her life. That's what happens when people cross endorse, when people form coalitions. Eric Adams is very aware that something like that could happen again. So people are going to try and figure this one out. But if the consensus among Democrats is that they want a new mayor, then we will have a new mayor. It's just a little difficult to see how that's all going to emerge in the next year or so, half year or so.
So one more thing, people up here have been paying really close attention to congestion pricing. You mentioned the Hudson Valley congressional races, which seem to have been weighing on Governor Hochul's mind when she abruptly put the pause in June. Now she's making some noise about revisiting the plan. It seems to me that there might be some sort of trial balloon between now and the new session in January before they really start talking about it again. Meantime, the MTA has to solve this big budget hole because of the lack of congestion pricing funding. So from Hochul's perspective, and then from the state legislature's perspective, was the pause a true pause? Or, I mean, does she really just not want to come back to this issue? What do you think?
I think she wants to pause it. She has substantive and political problems with the congestion pricing, the way it emerged. The substantive problem, which she happens to believe, some of us feel differently, but she happens to believe that that there are a lot of people who are, deli workers, security guards, nurses, nurse technicians, who have to commute into the city at odd hours, who for whatever reason, maybe they're in a transit desert, maybe they're carpooling. She pointed out to me once that, she used to work at as a county clerk who dealt with the DMV. She says, if you look at the motor vehicle registrations, there are a lot of people who have 10-year-old cars, 12-year-old cars. These are not wealthy commuters. And so she says they really need a break, and she really wants to provide it to them. That's the substantive part. Politically, it was a dead loser, and she took it off. She's not getting enough credit for this, but she took it off the agenda this year for these fall elections, where Democrats are, in fact, trying to flip or hold a number of seats in the nearby suburbs. It would have been a deadly issue for all of them, out in Long Island, certainly in the Hudson Valley. It would have crushed them. So I think she wants this resolved, and, I think we can see a path to the end. The end point, my prediction would be, based on everything I've heard her say, is that this will be done sometime in the next year, certainly before her reelection comes up in 2026, and that it will be done in a way that both creates a congestion charge, but makes it much lower and provides a lot of exemptions.
The exemptions is really...
Exemptions are the death of the thing, to be honest with you, Ian. I mean, I love my city. I was born here. I live here. I raised my kid here. I got a mortgage here. But this city has a lot of corruption. You cannot start creating loopholes. Once you start saying, oh, well, city workers should have an exemption. Oh, really? Which city workers? Should it be an EMT and, as opposed to, say, a buildings inspector? Should it be a teacher? Well, not really. The minute you open that, you crack that door open, and there's 300,000 municipal employees who are going to come charging right through it, and that'll be the end of the congestion side of it, and then you'll just have pricing plus congestion. I wouldn't rule out New York's ability to get the worst of both worlds, but I hope we have a different and better conversation about this that will be reasonably fair to everybody and also deal with the substance of the problem, which is that, average vehicle speed in parts of lower Manhattan are approaching 5 miles an hour. I mean, that's like you get a good jog going and you can go faster than driving in parts of this town.
And it's free to jog.
Yeah. But very true. Actually, it's better for you. I mean, look. In all seriousness, my feeling about it is, and I am one of these people. I am a car owner. I have to come into the city every day. If you don't charge me, I will drive in every day. You know. And look, this isn't about stopping traffic. Under the best case scenarios, according to the traffic engineers, you want to pare down traffic by something like 15%. You know, it's not going to stop you from coming in. You just have to pay more. So, you know, I mean, there's a price. I got a price point just like everybody else. you pass my price point, you will find me on the subway. If you say my price point is zero, hey, I'll just put on WAMC and sit in traffic all morning.
We'd be glad to have you, Errol, anytime. Well, it's always great catching up. Thanks so much for coming back on. And, you know, we'll touch base as we head toward early November. It's almost here.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.